Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. January 2021. So this, it's official, we're in winter retreat now as of this moment. So it's probably like expectations, ideas about how we might want the retreat to go. We might be very happy about the up-and-coming schedule, or we might be disappointed by it, but we haven't yet experienced it. The future is not yet arrived, not known. So we just take it as it comes and look out for each other. If we see that, and as far as the retreat crew, if you see that somebody maybe is struggling or has too much, and then helping out, looking out for each other. And then also our retreat crew manager, Tanjo Timanto, is also learning, so to be compassionate toward him. He'll get a brief snippet of what it's like to be an abbot. And then like Ajahn Suchito saying that winter retreat, one winter retreat, his famous quote of somebody asked him, when is the winter retreat going to start? And he said, for some, it's already started. For some, it never will. And so it's really a state of mind. And that state of mind of letting go. Getting into a mindset of dana as well is quite important. One of the Anagarikas was mentioning today that he would like to just split kindling to help the retreat crew out a little bit, and I had the thought that that's dana. Dana is when, it seems like a small thing, but it's when it's not imposed on us. So we do something for the sake of being of benefit, and it's not an imposition. We don't feel that it's an imposition. And so the heart has moved in a way of benefit, and that's dana, that's what we call dana. But if we do something that we feel like it's an imposition, then it's only natural that we won't want to put our heart into the activity, or we'll feel it'll have an unpleasant aspect to it. So if there's a schedule or the call wat or a way of acting in the monastery or some sort of duty that we have to undertake, we have that choice that we can take it as an imposition, or we can take it as putting the heart into it and bringing our own personal flair to the activity, and then it's dana. When we try to make it be of benefit, then it's dana. So there's that motivation that we can set, and we can do our practice like that too. We can do our practice either as we have that choice of I can meditate so that I'm a good Buddhist and doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and maybe I won't get criticized because I'm doing the right thing. Or we could do it as dana, where we give ourselves to the meditation and we do it with that attitude of, this is going to bring benefit for myself and other, for myself and others. So in that way, it changes the experience completely, and it's just based on the intention, based on the motivation. Everything hinges on that intentionality, the motivation, the intention with which we do things. So this particular winter retreat will be starting off with a full group schedule, and that'll be on the 8th. So today being the Lunar Observance Day, tomorrow, of course, being the day after, so open schedule tomorrow. And then the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, so that's 5 days of full community, full group schedule. And giving the retreat crew the opportunity to, the morning sitting and walking meditation period and the afternoon sitting and walking meditation periods being more optional for the lay people, for the retreat crew, so that the practice periods, it's not an imposition. And there's that opportunity to, if we're tired out from the work, from looking after the community, then we have the opportunity, you'll have the opportunity to take a rest if needed. But then there's also the morning and afternoon practice periods that are open if we feel that we do want to plug into that, then there's that opportunity as well. And the monastic community will be, we're the ones being looked after by the retreat crew, so we'll be here for that first 5 days of full schedule. And then after that, it'll open up. There'll be 4 monastics leading the full group schedule, although people have already said, oh yeah, I'm going to be plugging into those morning pujas. So it's not an imposition, but it's dana. It's the patipati puja, the practice puja, the practicing based on seeing the benefit, seeing the opportunity and taking the opportunity. So that container is there for anybody who might want that container of the morning and evening puja. So even if you're not on the one of the 4 monastics leading the group schedule for that 2-week period, the seat is always there, the opportunity is always there to come and plug in. There might be a tendency to going into winter retreat, going into a practice period like this, tendency to want to take things on, or the mind might start to complicate things. But we just come back to that simplicity of just the daily schedule and just plugging into it. This is a gift. This is an opportunity. It's a gift from the Buddha that we have this type of opportunity. And nobody has coerced us to come to the monastery or be in the monastery, and nobody's coercing us to stay here. So it's this way, us being here actually becomes a type of dana. Giving, the Buddha said, if we give our practice, that's the best gift, that's the highest gift. In the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the highest gift is the gift of the practice. Highest honor to the Buddha is the honoring him with our practice. So that's the this precious opportunity of winter retreat. It's incredibly rare in the world and incredibly precious. So to set that intention, to take the opportunity and make much of it, make much of the not having the burdens of the computers. We're really avoiding the computer use during this winter retreat if we're part of the monastic community. And that's a great blessing. That's rare these days. It used to be normal. It used to be normal to not have computers. But now we have computers and we think we need them. So it's now it's like we have to wean ourselves off and sort of deal with that perceived need or that addiction to our devices and so on. Come back to the daily schedule, the simplicity of the practice of the morning puja, the morning chore period, sweeping up, cleaning up, the sitting and walking meditation, listening to readings, listening to teachings, engaging in Dhamma discussion, and the mealtime, contemplating the food, maybe taking a short rest after the meal if needed, going for a walk, and 1:30 coming back for the afternoon practice period, and then the tea time. Well, there'll be Qigong also on offer during this retreat, and so that 4:30, that'll be the optional Qigong in the dining hall, or possibly outside if it's nice out. And then the tea time, evening puja. And there's also the noble silence, which is just speaking when necessary, not engaging so much in just the idle conversation, but with a like noble silence, I think of that as like chanting, Dhamma discussion. And so one way to do this can then become a lot of space. We have a lot of space and a lot of time. And so there could be some sort of study, some sort of sutta study. I remember as a novice, I was reading Patipada by Ajahn Mahabua and getting really into that during the winter retreat. So I was doing that at the tea time and reading that because there's just so much space that opens up that it's good to have some sort of study, some sort of reading that we might do extra if we feel like the mind might get a bit tight if we try to meditate the whole time. So, or if the mind has that tendency to want to seek some sort of distraction, then it's okay to distract ourselves with a Dhamma book or reading suttas. And it's natural for when we focus more on the meditation, then it's natural to get caught by different obstructive states in the mind where we habitually react with either greed or aversion, and so getting to know that and getting to know the hindrances better, that's just something that happens on retreat, and it's totally normal and it's good. This is the process of purification. And the theme of this particular winter retreat is the life of the Buddha, and we'll see where that takes us. In the beginning, we'll start out with just some basic meditation instructions and getting into retreat mode, getting into the meditation, and then going into the life story of the Buddha, using that as a framework, but we'll see where that takes us. Various suttas connected with the Buddha's life might also get into biographies and lives of the great disciples of the Buddha as they appear in the Buddha's life. Giving us a sense of the life of the Buddha being a process we all emulate or go through, at least in part. If we come to the monastery, have a desire to practice, and so we all can resonate with the life of the Buddha, hopefully. Something that can happen on the full group schedule as well is like getting tired or it's so easy to have a lot of expectations for how the meditation is supposed to go, how the practice is supposed to go, and we try to idealize our experience, comparing it to the suttas or how we interpret the suttas, and it's just so easy to get stuck in these ideas. So to come to the practice, come to the full group schedule with a sense of dana and a sense of openness to the experience and interest, taking an interest in the experience of the meditation. And so if it's like remembering what Lungpo Cha said, if it's good, that's good. If it's not good, that's good. The point being, we're doing the practice. Whether we're peaceful, that's good. If we're not peaceful, that's good. It's just getting on with the practice, investigating, you know, what's going on here. The mind can just do all sorts of things when we're in winter retreat, and it's really interesting, really fascinating. And sometimes the mind, it calms down a bit, and sometimes the mind just gets really mean and unforgiving and is just like criticizing everybody and everything, getting really righteous, judging everybody and everything. It's such a burden, but the mind just does that, and it's sometimes for me it's kind of like, why do you got to be so mean, mind? Why does the mind have to be like that? Why can't it just be nice all the time? Sometimes it can help to label it like mean mind. That's mean mind. Mean mind. So there's mean mind and nice mind. And sometimes just recognizing it or labeling it. Or unforgiving mind, or even enraged mind, vicious mind. Because it can get like that, and it can be very irrational. I think the mind is quite irrational a lot of the time. So not to expect it to be logical or rational. Or sometimes it's maybe even too logical. Why aren't they doing it? It doesn't make sense. Why are they doing it that way? That doesn't make any sense. So it can get overly logical in a very righteous way. So coming back to just, okay, breathing in, breathing out, just forgiving, forgiving with myself, forgiving with others. Or it can get very worried. I can't do this, it's just too much. The full schedule is just too much. Well, what's happening right now? Sitting here, breathing in, breathing out. So the mind tends to the sense of worry that's a hindrance, and then it keeps stacking up the worries until we have a big pile of worry. And so just relinquishing, letting go. That's chaga. So we have dana, and then we have chaga, which is the, I think of chaga as more of a mental relinquishment. Just letting things fall away. Just allowing things to fall away. And for me, this is where the life of the Buddha really comes in and becomes very inspiring. Seeing how the Buddha reacted to different situations, seeing how he taught different types of people who were in different places, different states. And then seeing his own example, not only the practice and training that he undertook, the self-training that he undertook to achieve Buddhahood, but also afterward, and how he set the example, how he set the tone, the feeling tone for the teaching, for the Dhamma. One of the things I find inspiring is that he didn't necessarily look to teach large groups of people. After the Enlightenment, went to teach just 5 people, just walked across India, across northern India to teach 5 people. And then spent the first Vasa at the deer park and taught just those 5 people, those first 5 bhikkhus. You get the sense he wasn't setting the intention to teach as many people as possible. Right at the beginning there, he's thinking, well, who's going to understand this? Who has the ability to understand the Dhamma? And, okay, well, there's these 5 people who were practicing with me before, maybe they can understand. And then it did go from there. You have the Buddha keeping a promise that he made early on in his practice. So he keeps this promise to King Bimbisara. So when the Buddha left the home life and first started practicing, first became a monk and began doing his alms rounds. So this is even before he met his first teachers, Alara Kalama and Uddhakaramaputta. So this is even before that. And this is where this reflection, this wisely reflecting, I use alms food, not for fun, not for pleasure, and so on. It comes from the Bodhisatta, the monk, the Samana Gotama, teaching himself how to reflect on food, that it's not appropriate to, he mixes the food together in the bowl and realizes it's no longer appropriate for him to be focusing on the different types of flavors and the different types of food, and he mixes it all together in his bowl. And that's where that wisely reflecting comes from. That's the first instance we see it. And word quickly spreads that there's this warrior noble monk who has this unusual demeanor for a samana, for a monk. And King Bimbisara gets word of this and he decides he wants to meet this monk that's come to his kingdom. This is the kingdom of Magadha. The Bodhisatta, where he grew up, was the kingdom of, or the province of Kosala, And then when he left the home life, he went all the way into the next kingdom of Magadha. And so King Bimbisara then, hearing about this, and wants to meet him. So this meeting happens, and the Buddha-to-be, the Samana Gotama, has not been long ordained at that point. And so King Bimbisara sees him and pays respects to him and says, you're really inspiring. Your look and your demeanor and everything about you is very inspiring. And he says, you just look like a very kingly and very royal, and can I offer you, say, a piece of this kingdom? You seem worthy of a kingdom. And the Samana Gotama, with addressing King Bimbisara in verses, saying, I've left behind a kingdom. I don't aspire to own land or have any type of sensual pleasure. And King Bimbisara is even more inspired by this and says, you are more humble than me and you're more fit to be the king of this entire kingdom. I offer you the entire kingdom. And he says, and then the Samana Gotama replying with verses saying, an entire kingdom to me is no more valuable than dust. And what I aspire to is so much greater than even that, that this is the life I lead, to relinquish sensual pleasures. And then King Bimbisara says, if you attain your goal, if you attain the deathless, please remember me. I'd like to be one of your first students. And so fast forward to the Enlightenment, the first Vasa of the Deer Park, the first five disciples, and then the Buddha then starts toward Magadha and back toward Magadha. And he remembers that promise that he did agree then that if he attained the deathless, that King Bimbisara would be one of his first students. And so he makes his way by stages there. Of course, on the way, he teaches and brings to Arhantship the 1,000 fire ascetics, the 3 Kasapa brothers, and makes his way to Rajagaha, and then has this meeting with King Bimbisara, who then eventually, then he offers the Bamboo Grove, the first monastery. And so all these interesting connections with the life of the Buddha that I hope to explore and go into, and hopefully that leads to a sense of developing adhitana, developing determination and perseverance ourselves, and following that example, because it's because of that life of the Buddha that we're even here today, that there are any monasteries in the world, that there is any Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Chah and all of the other great adepts of every country, and it all comes back to the Buddha. This is the source. Mindfulness comes from the Buddha. The whole Vipassana tradition, this is all sourced from the Buddha. To disconnect it from the Buddha is to not recognize the source, not recognize the origins of these things. And so to come back to the source, to come back to the origin, is really to come back to the Buddha. And then through that example, that's what's contained in the meditation object of Bhutto. So the forest masters in Thailand, many of them teaching and praising this practice of Bhutto, of just combining it with the breath. Sometimes it's breathing in Bhutto, breathing out Bhutto. Sometimes it's taught breathing in Bhut, breathing out To, mentally reciting Bhutto. And that life of the Buddha is contained within that. That faith in the Buddha is contained within that. And then also the internal Buddha, which really the historical Buddha was pointing to the internal Buddha, the knowing, the puru, the one who knows. And that's also Bhutto. So there's that faith. With that faith comes that determination. And with that determination comes the inward going knowing into Bhutto. So it's a very simple, very basic thing. We don't need to stack too much on top of that, but just coming back to Bhutto. So life of the Buddha is really, it's connected with the recollection of Bhutto, that meditation object. And the Dhamma comes from the Buddha, the Sangha comes from the Buddha, and there's that sense of wonder and just, how did he do that? How did he leave the home life? And then partly relying on teachers, of his teachers Alara, Kalama, and Uddaka Ramaputta, but then going further than that and without relying on a teacher, just trying things, trying the extreme austerity and realizing that wasn't the path. But just the fact that he did that is pretty unbelievable. And with that lack of attachment to this very life. And that's definitely not to recommend the extreme austerities that the Buddha did, and I don't think any of us would be capable of that anyway. And the Buddha in the sutta is saying, like, if the extreme austerities were necessary for liberation, it would be worth it. But it's not necessary for liberation. And this is like being given a wish-fulfilling jewel. This is unbelievable. It's like the Dhamma just being handed to us on a silver platter for us to feast on. And it's just there. It's just made available. It's amazing. So coming back to that sense of investigation as well. And I think faith is really important, because without the requisite faith and the energy based on that faith, or that confidence in the Buddha, without that, the investigation isn't going to have that requisite interest. So that interest really needs to be there. So finding ways to get interested in Bhutto. It's kind of like thinking about the world. So if we think about the earth, it's interesting. It's very interesting in many ways. And we also think about maybe history and human history, and this is all very interesting, and human belief systems in the past, and how the human mind doesn't really change over the millennia. So I was just thinking about this recently, that in so many ways, there's so many parallels to the way that modern scientific human thought is actually similar to ancient ways of thinking. And like you take the stars, for example, and the Native Americans or Aboriginal peoples referring to the stars as the ancestors. And then we might think with modern scientific thinking, oh, that's kind of, you know, primitive to think like that, or not scientific. But then according to science, we're looking into the past when we look at a star that's 100 light years away or 1,000 light years away. Then we're looking into the past. And so how is that not an ancestor? How are we not looking at the ancestors? So these similarities, and then the mind starts to get interested when we start to think like that and start to make connections, that the intelligence can make connections when that interest is there, that interest in making connections that might normally not get seen or might get overlooked. And they're all right in front of us. So we make the similar types of connections in the body and mind, looking at how is the knowing operating? What's directing the knowing? What's directing consciousness? How are the khandhas impermanent, unsatisfactory, not self? How is the body this way? Why is it difficult for the mind to settle? Why does it get stirred up, you know, looking into these things? Like the body, trying to make the body still in meditation, and then there's this inherent unsatisfactoriness in the body. And no matter how still we get, there's still the heartbeat, there's still the blood flow, there's that motion in the body. Even though we calm the body down as much as we can, the blood is still flowing, the heart is still beating. So then we see that. We see, well, the peace doesn't come from the body stopping. The blood's not going to stop. The heart's not going to stop. There's always going to be that internal motion, that internal vibration in the body. So it must be the mind settling. The mind can settle. The mind can be still. So the body is impermanent. It's always in flux. It's always in motion. It's always aging. That's not a refuge. So then we look to train the mind. But then the mind has its own blips and vibrations. And how does that happen? What is a thought? Looking into thought, looking into the nature of thought. What's a good thought? What's a bad thought? What's a perception? In Bhikkhu Nyanamoli's Life of the Buddha, he starts out the book with Ananda speaking to a group of bhikkhus about the wonderful and marvelous qualities of the Tathagata, of the Buddha. And there's various miraculous things that, according to the stories, happened with his birth and so on. And then the Buddha, having spent the day in seclusion, it's about early evening time, he comes in and says, "Oh, what were you guys talking about?" And Ananda relates, "Oh, I was talking about the wonderful and marvelous qualities of the Buddha, that the Buddha can know of the past Buddhas who lived millions of years ago or whatever, in past ages gone, he can know of them and know of their disciples." And the Buddha says, "Well, okay, well, while I'm sitting here, go ahead and say some more wonderful and marvelous qualities of the Buddha." And so Ananda says, "Okay, well, the birth was unusual and amazing in various ways, and things that happened around the birth of the Bodhisattva were amazing, and different qualities of the Buddha are amazing and miraculous." And then the Buddha says, "Well, do you want to know another wonderful and marvelous quality of the Buddha?" And Ananda says, "Yes, of course." And he says, "Well, another wonderful and marvelous quality of the Buddha is that when a thought arises, the Buddha knows a thought has arisen. When a thought sustains, he knows it's sustained. When it ceases, he knows it ceases. When a perception arises, he knows a perception has arisen. When a perception sustains itself, he knows a perception has sustained itself. When a perception ceases, he knows a perception ceases." And this is also a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Buddha. And then the sutta ends there. And so there's these different sides to the Buddha. There's the Buddha lifting that up in terms of this is what should be contemplated. This is what the Buddha's teaching is about. This is what should be looked at. Yes, there are amazing and miraculous things about the life of the Buddha, you know, according to the stories, according to the suttas, according to the commentaries, But also there's this practical side, there's this practical teaching of which we can all practice. So the winter retreat and this time, this long period of time, 3 months that we have to consider these things and apply the teaching of the Buddha, apply the life of the Buddha to our own lives, the Tathagata, the thus come one. And this is really what we're here for. We're wearing the, for those of us who have taken on the brown robes, wearing the banner of the Buddha, the banner of the Arhats, these simple brown robes, many of which dyed with natural dyes, and just very basic, and we use them. We try to follow the Buddha's teaching of using the robes, using the cloth we wrap around ourselves without being tied to it, using it for the sake of covering the body, for the sake of warmth, and without being infatuated by it, tied to it, keeping the mind cool. All of the Buddha's teachings are to cool the mind down, cool the defilements. So just to, by way of introduction, and also just to hope that we all look out for each other and spread that metta, the goodwill during the winter retreat as we go into this, and just think of that word, the Tathagata, the thus come one, the getting into the etymology of that word that can also lead to insight. And so I'll just leave it there for this evening. I think that's enough.
And inherit its results, their future. intention, be they skillful or harmful, of such acts they will be the heirs.
Disciples
who have practiced well.